Well, I don't usually dress like this, but this mala was given to me by Sam for my participation here, and I just thought it was appropriate to wear on this evening. As Barbara mentioned, I've been out of town for a while, and so I missed your first night here. I was able to go to the first night that SBMG had here before I left. I really wanted to see the place. So I came here, and Richard Shankman was speaking. It's really nice. But this is my first night to be here with Sim. So I thought I'd wear my little Sim mala. And you know, I mean, just to start with, reflect a little bit on this incredible journey that we've had together from, you know, just the idea of a couple of people to wonder, really, came out of curiosity. I wonder if, you know, two or three sanghas could get together and put together something like this. And it just was this dream, this pipe dream, really. And, you know, 6-7 years ago, Jerry Simpkins and I were on this committee with people from SBMG and Valley Streams that spent a year just asking the question, is this even possible? And it took us a year to say, yes. Yes, it's possible. So, and now here we are, and it's, wow, just to see the faces is really, really special. So, really happy to be with you all tonight. And I come out of 6 weeks of retreat to a changed country and perhaps a changed world. Something on the order of a third of the people at my retreat were from countries other than the U.S., yeah, and just as us, but in a different way. They were in shock from the outcome of the election. They gave us the option of finding out what happened. They put a little piece of paper up on the board that you could lift. You know, it said presidential election results, and you could lift the piece of paper, and it just said, winner, Donald Trump. Wow. And, you know, it became pretty clear from people walking around that something was going on. So the following day, they offered a speaking session to process. It was council style, just say how you're feeling kind of thing. And so it was pretty obvious that the expected had not happened at that point. And then we came out with 3 days of speaking. Most of the folks, or half the folks, had been there for 3 months. I just did the second half. The 6 weeks. So for them, they gave 3 days of transition where about half the day was speaking and the rest was in silence. So had a chance to kind of get a feel for where people were at. And from the talks I've been able to listen to and look at the titles, I think Dennis and Diane have done a good job of working with the kind of chaos and change and things that we're dealing with every day at a lesser level, right? I mean, these are things that we know about from our practice. I mean, we know about the chaos of the mind. We know that change is a constant in our lives. And then all of a sudden, something like this comes along and makes it real at this macro scale. So I've really found with practice that very subtle little realizations that we might have in our practice that we may just let go by often show up in the world in really big ways, either in our personal lives or at a larger scale. So what I thought I would do is counterbalance some of the angst and speculation and quite real anxiety around potential things that might happen in the next 4 years with a reflection on our blessings. The Buddha gave, in response to a question about, what are blessings, he gave a very short sutta, very short discourse called the Mahamangala Sutta, the greatest blessing. And he just listed 38 things. Now, that might seem like a lot, But I think once you hear the list, and you get a feel for the kind of everyday things that he talked about as the greatest blessings, you might realize that in your own life, many or most of these are present. So as we go through them, kind of be checking, how many of these are in my life? How many could be in my life? We'll see where that takes us. I might just read it. There's not really a great translation out there. This is in the Sutta Nipata, so it's in the book of the shorter writings and the smaller books. And so Bhikkhu Bodhi hasn't gotten to it. So I've got. I don't even think this is Thanissaro Bhikkhu, but I've got one that I pulled down from online. And I'll just read you the blessings. Not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise, and to honor those who are worthy of honor, this is the greatest blessing. To reside in a suitable locality, to have done meritorious actions in the past and set oneself on the right course, this is the greatest blessing. To have much learning, to be skillful in handicraft, well trained in discipline, and to be of good speech, this is the greatest blessing. To support mother and father, to cherish wife and children, and to be engaged in peaceful occupation, this is the greatest blessing. To be generous in giving, to be righteous in conduct, to help one's relatives, and to be blameless in action, this is the greatest blessing. To loathe evil and abstain from it, to refrain from intoxicants, and to be steadfast in virtue, this is the greatest blessing. To be respectful, humble, contented, and grateful, and to listen to the Dhamma when it's timely, this is the greatest blessing. To be patient and obedient, to associate with monks, and to have religious discussions, this is the greatest blessing. Self-restraint, a holy and chaste life, the perception of the noble truths, and the realization of nibbana, this is the greatest blessing. A mind unruffled by the vagaries of fortune, from sorrow freed, from defilements cleansed, from fear liberated, this is the greatest blessing. Those who thus abide ever remain invincible. In happiness established, these are the greatest blessings. So we see that we have some very everyday things, and we have some very extraordinary things. We have a progression here. You know, it starts with associating with the foolish, honoring those who are worthy of honor, where we live, you know, taking care of our relatives, and it progresses all the way to the realization of nibbana, and then those properties after that were the properties of a mind that has attained freedom. And we might think of these as breaking down into categories. A number of them are kind of external qualities. Number of them are internal qualities that we possess. Quite a few of them are speaking about our relationships with people. There are a few spiritual practices mentioned here, and then the ones at the end are all kind of spiritual attainments. So let's just go through it again and kind of tease out some of these to a little bit more detail, and how we might either realize that we actually have this in our life, or maybe aspire to see what we can do to bring it into our life. So it starts with not associating with the foolish, but to associate with the wise. Well, you're here. So that's a great start. And, you know, some of us find with Dharma practice, after a while, some of the folks that we've been hanging around with don't sit so well. And other ones feel like a better fit for the practice that we've now undertaken. So it's something to consider, it's something to look at, is, you know, how does that fit feel with our various groups of people that we associate with after you've been doing this practice for a while, after you've been around people that actually have the intention to be kind, to be compassionate, to try to understand the point of view of others that we might not agree with, and to actually, you know, train our minds to be less reactive. How does that feel to be around those kind of people as opposed to maybe being around some other kind of people? Or for that matter, to be in places, virtual places online, where we're reading words from people that are, you know, overreacting or using harsh language or all of these things that we wouldn't put up with in person, but that somehow we buffer ourselves from that that caution when we're online. So there's plenty of foolishness online, and it's a little more difficult to associate with the wise, but consider that. Honoring those who are worthy of honor. People used to ask the Buddha, well, who's worthy of honor? Because, you know, in the system of that day, the religious system of that day, when you gave to people that were worthy of honor, you earned merit. And when you gave to people that were worthy of more honor, you earned more merit. So that's why it was a question of the day. It was really important to know that. And basically how we broke it down was that people with noble spiritual qualities are probably your first priority. And then your parents or your lineage, you know, your parents, grandparents, and so forth. Really important to honor them. And then elders of any kind in the community. And then immediate family members. It's kind of the way he broke it down of those that are worthy of honor. So, you know, just looking for opportunities to do that. And then you'll remember he had supporting mother and father and helping out our relatives later in this list. So he reiterates those. But those, that's similar to honoring those who are worthy of honor. Now this one is really relevant to our move here. To reside in a suitable locality. So, I don't know about you, but at the moment I'm very grateful I live in California. You know, I don't know how many of you heard Barbara Boxer's speech on her retirement from the Senate, but she's also very grateful to be living in California, to return to a place that, as she said, shares her values. And we're very fortunate, you know, in living in this city that we have such access to the Dharma. And since this is a Dharma talk, I'll talk about that. I mean, I love the coffee and the micro breweries and all that too, but and the access to the rivers and all of that. But really, I mean, the fact that this center was even worth thinking about, even within the realm of possibility, is really astounding. And then the fact we were able to pull it off. You know, think about the generosity and the intention and the hard work, the effort, and the, you know, pushing ahead when things seemed so dark. That when we lost the B Street building, you remember the feeling, how that felt? You know, we really wanted that building. And, you know, it didn't work for everybody. And the way the process was set up was to honor everybody that was engaged in the process. And, you know, that building is now being used by the Lion's Roar of Vajrayana Sangha. So the fact, you know, that that circle of Dharma in this town is working in that way is really astounding. So we're very fortunate, no matter what you might think of Sacramento, we're very fortunate to be here and to have access to the Dharma in the way that we do, to say nothing of the fact that we've got you know, the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City with their amazing offerings. We've got, you know, Spirit Rock. We've got all of these teachers in the Bay Area that have their sanghas, mostly Spirit Rock teachers, but there's the East Bay Meditation Center with its diversity. We just have a lot to choose from that we can be very thankful for. And, you know, again, not to be completely negative about the internet, the access that we now have to teachings from throughout the world is really astounding. And so in a way, to reside in a suitable locality, but also to reside in the place that we live, in the time that we live, is really astounding. So let's cherish that. There's a mythological teaching that I heard about on this retreat where, you know, the Buddha said, or not the Buddha, but somebody after him, said that the Dharma will be around for 2,500 years, and then there'll be this 100-year period that's absolutely extraordinary, the flowering. It'll be like a golden age of the Dharma. And then it'll start fading away, and in 5,000 years, the Dharma will be gone from the earth. So there are other ways that the Buddha talked about it that weren't quite that linear, or I guess parabolic. There's this golden age. But no matter how you phrase it, we're in the golden age that was in that prophecy. We're somewhere between 2,500-2,600 years from when the Buddha lived. And the people that track this stuff...
Hello.
Ivan, welcome. The people that track this kind of stuff think that when Mahasi Sayadaw presided over the Congress of the Buddhists, whether it was the third or fifth or sixth, whatever it was since the Buddhist time, in the 50s, that was like the middle of this 100-year flowering. So, you know, really wonderful to be in the midst of all that. To have much learning, again, you know, we've got access to all these wonderful teachers that come into town, and we have the wisdom of each of you that you have access to every time you show up here. So, and then, again, with the internet, all of the online courses, I mean, you know, the Majjhima course that many of us have taken, you know, Steve's Abhidhamma course that I just did this fall, you know, Dave just took Steve's course on the Manual of Insight, which was by Mahasi Sayadaw, book that Mahasi Sayadaw wrote. That's all available online. You know, we don't need to travel to Burma to learn about these things anymore. This is available to us. So, you know, if it fits with your lifestyle and your means and your ability and your time and your other obligations to family and civic community, see if there is an appropriate course that you might want to take and learn from that. To be skillful in handicraft, the first thing I thought of is these beautiful statues that we have, and this is the first time I've seen this one since Dennis donated it, but it's absolutely extraordinary. And you know, the other one we have at the back, the Kuan Yin that we have, just beautiful handicrafts, these tankas. You know, you think about the craft that it takes to paint something like that. That's a painting. I mean, it's amazing. And you go over there to Kathmandu and you see these people working on these, and it's just extraordinary. But something like this, you know, it's not only beautiful in the sense of nice to look at, pleasing to the eye, but it's beautiful in the message that it portrays. And it's something that furthers our practice. And when you have something like this to inspire you, it furthers the practice. And so that kind of handicraft, Noni's metta chant, the Japanese weaving that she does, that's around, I saw it somewhere, I'm not sure. It's over here on the counter. And just check that out close up. And it's good on both sides. It doesn't have a back. You know, it's front and back are both have the same message. So check that out. But just to be able to have that kind of talent and to share it, first of all, to share it with people, and then to particularly to be producing things that inspire our practice is really noteworthy. Well-trained in discipline, here they're talking about the precepts, and a number of these reflect the precepts. I looked over the I kind of went through the list with the eye of trying to find all the precepts in here, and I couldn't find one specifically that said do no harm, which seems really surprising. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I do no harm, I feel pretty good. But definitely, to be generous in giving is the second precept, right? Because that's the opposite of being stingy or of taking what's not freely offered. The third precept is in here in the form of a holy and chaste life. The fourth precept is here in to be of good speech. And the fifth precept is here to refrain from intoxicants. So first is probably here in some form that I'm just not wise enough to recognize. But all the other ones are here explicitly. And a number of these deal with sila, with moral conduct. Supporting one's mother and father. So, you know, I think in this modern day and age, we need to recognize that that means supporting one's people that brought us up. You know, I mean, whether that's two moms or, you know, a single parent that worked two or three jobs to get us to where we are today, whatever it might be, we need to honor that. But there's a specific reason that I think that comes to mind when I read supporting mother and father, and that is this precious human birth. The fact that we were born, and, you know, at the time of the Buddha, the only way to do that was to have a mother and a father. There were no test tubes available, or sperm banks, or anything. So, this precious human birth, the way that the Buddha talked about it is, he says, it is as rare to be born as a human as if a blind turtle were swimming in the ocean and surfaced in the middle of a ring that was floating on the surface. That's how rare it is to be born as a human. We have this extraordinary ability. And, you know, whether you believe the Buddhist cosmology or not, about these seven realms, you know, so there are these realms where all these gods and devas and stuff live. And they're a little bit too happy to practice. Things are a little bit too pleasant. And then there are the hell realms or the animal realms, and they're having a tough time. You know, they got some stuff to work out. They don't feel good enough to practice, you know. It's really in this human realm where we have the ability to practice. So, I mean, if you believe in like the devas and the very two sea to heavens and all these higher realms, what has to happen to them is that they're there for a really long time because it's so pleasant they don't want to leave. But when they finally like get booted out of that world, what happens to them is that they're guaranteed a human birth. And they come here and this is where they finish their work. You know, that's an apology. So, it's just another way of emphasizing how precious this human life is. And so I think that's one reason that the mother and father are emphasized. And then closely related to that, in this realm of caring for our very close relatives, it's to cherish our spouse, our partner, and any children that we might have. And the other way of translating blessing is the conditions for happiness, conducive to happiness, things that are conducive to happiness. So we can think of blessings as something that just by chance has appeared in our life. We can also think of it as things that we either have or don't have and recognize as being conducive to happiness, so that if we search them out, if they're not in our life, we search them out, it's really a way of enhancing the happiness in our lives. And we're talking here about a kind of deep and lasting happiness, you know, not the quick happiness that a chocolate bar or a cup of coffee might bring, but really something deeper, a deeper kind of happiness that that's really the point of this practice, right? You know, I mean, the point of this practice, even though we're all here to some extent because of suffering, we wouldn't be here if we didn't want to be happy. Mm-hmm. So, learning about things that are conducive to happiness, I think, is very useful. To be engaged in peaceful occupation, you know, what we might think in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path as wise livelihood, And again, I went through the list, and I was able to find the whole Noble Eightfold Path. You know, right view, right intention, they're all here in some form. And, you know, that's pretty obvious. I mean, when you have a job that sucks, you know, you've read that phrase a few times, I'm sure, this job sucks. I had a friend once that told me, only 15 more years to retirement. And I said to myself, he was a co-worker. He ran the other half of the office that I was helping to run. Yeah, I just resolved at that moment, I would never want to say hear anything close to those words come out of my mouth. You know, and sure enough, I mean, things didn't work out so well for him. You know, having that attitude toward work, things didn't work out so well. Some unhappiness came within 5 years after that statement. So, be careful what you put off. To be generous in giving. You've all heard enough Donna talk that I don't think I need to reemphasize this one. And just the fact, you know, look around. I mean, if you need to know the happiness that generosity brings, just look around the building and you know, just look, think about all the benefits that Sim has brought us, and none of that would be here if it weren't for Donna. So that one's pretty clear about generous in giving, and you've all heard what the Buddha said about, you know, it makes you happy before, when you're thinking about what you're going to give, it makes you happy while you're giving it, it makes you happy when you reflect on what you've given. So, to be righteous in conduct, that's sila again. Helping one's relatives, to be blameless in action, that's sila again. It's also right action, it's another step on the Noble Eightfold Path. To cease and abstain from evil, so that's wise effort, right? That's half of wise effort, to cease and then abstain from evil, and then with positive things, to cultivate those that aren't here and to help the ones that are here to sustain. I have a note to myself here. When I went through and tried to find the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path, the only two that weren't here were mindfulness and concentration. Oh. Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting, because those are the last two. So I thought it was, and again, maybe they're here and I don't recognize it because of the archaic wording or whatever. But if you go to Access to Insight, there's a talk on this by a person that I've never heard of. That has three versions of this. It has a Pali version, just straight. It has the English version, this is it. And it has a word-by-word translation of the Pali. So it doesn't try to make it flow, but it has every single word with the word right next to it. And Sati wasn't there. I mean, I went through it. Sati wasn't there. Samadhi wasn't there. So it's interesting to me, again, you know, that of all the steps of the Noble Eightfold Path, those are the only two that I couldn't find. Refraining from intoxicants, we already talked about. Being steadfast in virtue, again, sila. You getting the idea? It's really important to mind your manners here, because if you don't, you're going to be miserable. You and a lot of other people around you. being respectful. I think to some extent what he was probably talking about there was that same list of being honoring those who are worthy of honor. But I think in this day and age, with the rhetoric that's flying around from all sides, we need to be respectful to everyone, whether we like them or not. I mean, wouldn't that be a great little resolution for the new year, is to try to be respectful to people even when we disagree with them? I think that would be awesome. I would like that. The next three remind me of the Metta Sutta, you know? Humble and contented, those are right at the beginning, right? Humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. And so I love the way that those are paired right next to each other. It remind me of the Metta Sutta. And then gratitude. And, you know, just to show the link between gratitude and happiness, the Philip Moffat, at his website, was talking about gratitude, and he said that the Buddha would often instruct a monk to take his ground cloth into the forest, sit at the base of a tree, and begin gladdening the heart by reflecting on the series of fortunate circumstances that had given the monk the motivation and ability to seek freedom through understanding the Dharma. So gratitude of any kind gladdens the heart. You know, that's the lesson here. And then again, since this is Dharma talk, you know, I'd really recommend reflecting on your own practice. It's something that we can do that really, it brings us joy. And then after you've been practicing for a little while, like at least a week, you can actually look back and see benefits that have started to come from the practice. And reflecting on those is really a good thing to do. I don't know how many of you kind of jolted at the word obedience. Yeah, at least one, besides me. First time I heard that in this list, I thought, obedient, what's that about, you know? I don't want somebody telling me what to do. But what apparently what that word really means, according to Steve Armstrong, and I trust him on this one, is open to learning. It means you're, the other way I've seen it translated is amenable to correction. So those are all in the same realm. That's better than obedient. Because obedient, somebody's telling you what to do, and you're, all right, you know, a beaten dog or something. But open to learning and amenable to correction have a very different flavor of, you know, we come here seeking some sort of wisdom or direction or guidance or, you know, we're kind of more in that realm than somebody saying, do this, you know. And was okay, I will. But you know, the Buddha said, "Find out for yourself." Ahipasako, you know, come and find out for yourself, and don't believe what I say until you've tested it in your own experience. So that's much more consistent with the idea of being open to learning and being amenable to correction. Is this idea that we're going to learn things for ourselves, and that's the only way we're really going to learn it. And having someone tell us, "Believe this," and oh, all right, you know, that's not going to stick. You're going to leave, get out of that person's orbit, and you're just going to go back to your old habits, right? So, I like that those other translations better. Patience, you know, this is, Kamala Masters called that the highest virtue. Mm-hmm. And there's a great quote from the Anguttara Nikaya, verse 140, that pertains to tonight. How is the practitioner patient? By being resilient to cold, heat, hunger, and thirst, to the touch of flies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and reptiles, to ill-spoken, unwelcome words and bodily feelings that when they arise are painful, piercing, disagreeable, displeasing, and menacing to life. It's a pretty long list, and hopefully out of that whole list, only one of them was present tonight, the cold. So I consider yourself lucky. Pardon?
It's just the timing.
Yeah.
The hot flash.
Okay. And she's having a hot flash, so she didn't even have the cold. So, good for you. The next one is similar to the very first one, to associate with monks, which, you know, as we've heard many times, the word bhikkhu really should be translated as fellow practitioners. So that's what we're doing again by coming here. To have timely religious discussions, that's what we're doing, even though some people don't consider this religious. Disclaimer, this is an educational nonprofit, so we're having timely discussions. May or may not be religious. Frame them however you want. Self-restraint, there's sila again. Holy and chaste life, that's the third precept. Perception of the noble truths, that's the definition of wise view, which is the first step in the Noble Eightfold Path. The realization of nibbana. Well, I don't know that one yet, but Steve Armstrong has changed the phrase that he uses to teach about nibbana now. He calls it falling into nibbana. And the teachers that I'm hanging around these days talk about nibbana as something that's very close. It's right here, but we can't see it. It's because it requires a paradigm shift in the mind. So it's very, very close, and at some point, you know, we have these little flashes, and then they go away. So the classical idea of nirvana is this sort of permanent state, right? And Tony Bernhardt talks about it as a verb, that it's actually your nirvana-ing, your cooling. The source of that word is the extinguishing of a flame, the cooling. And so I think we should stop thinking about nirvana as this far-off, distant enlightenment. The other quote that Steve's using these days is from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and he says, nirvana is an accident. Practice makes us accident prone. So again, that idea, we fall into it, you know, we trip and fall into it. I mean, Ananda was sort of leaning over, right, to go to sleep, and he was fully awakened in that moment. So, I don't know, I'm liking that whole Buddha Dasa idea of everyday nirvana, you know, these very brief little moments that we get and sometimes don't notice. Try to notice those a little bit more. That might be another New Year's resolution. Try to notice those little slippery moments that sort of pop up, and then it might be in a sitting, but it might be when you're feeding your cat, you know, it might be when you're looking a good friend in the eye. Just noticing those moments when just for a minute we're at peace. Just for a minute, we don't want anything that isn't here already. Timothy Miller, psychologist from Stockton, wrote a book, and I love the title, How to Want What You Have. You know, if we could all want what we have, wouldn't that be total freedom? We'd never want the moment to be other than it is. You know, even when there's flies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and reptiles, it would all be good. We'd be fine with any of that. That would be nice. And then the other ones are description of the mind of someone who's free. And again, we can have tastes of these, even if we don't maybe fully realize them. A mind unruffled by the eight worldly winds, the vagaries of fortune is the way it's translated. But literally, they use the same word as for the eight worldly winds that Heather did her talk on and that Laura did a talk on a while ago. These vicissitudes of life, you know, praise and blame, gain and loss, all of that. So to be unruffled by all of that, wouldn't that be wonderful? Freed from sorrow, that's the whole idea of freedom, is that we're being freed from sorrow, lamentation, and grief. Cleansed of the defilements, well, we kind of got the order wrong here. I mean, that comes first, right? We cleanse the mind of the defilements, and then the pure mind just emerges. It just comes out. Its radiance is no longer covered. It's uncovered and free to shine in the world. And then liberated from fear, you know, obviously. There is fear in the land right now, and wouldn't it be sweet to be liberated from fear? So that is what we've got. I would like, before I have my little closing poem here, if I have Diane's permission to go a couple minutes past 9 o'clock, I would like to hear from you of which of these strike you as, oh yeah, I know that one. I feel that. And maybe some examples. And then which of those are just like, what? What was Buddha talking about? It makes no sense at all. But were the things going through the list that particularly struck you, really touched your heart, and others that were just kind of, huh? That doesn't make sense. Or do they just go by so fast that they're all a blur?
Well, you said it yourself, but there was a real wave of good feeling when you read the first piece about not being around fools and being around wise people. It was not just a theory. I felt a palpable recognition of what a blessing to see the people in this room who have a commitment to seeing things through a lens of wisdom. There's a real sense of yes, this is a gift.
Yeah. Thank you.
find any patients, but
exactly
have patients,
right,
then I'm in a much more balanced place where I'm just able to be more present and more unruffled by the winds of whatever that one is.
Right.
And when I'm not feeling patient, that's a real reminder to me that it's like, wow, I'm not balanced well.
Right.
Because then I'm being more reactive or being more wanting to be somewhere else. So I think that was really real. And the peace that comes with when I'm feeling patient is really noticeable.
Yeah. Right, and the agitation that comes when you're feeling impatient is quite noticeable as well. Yeah.
And it can be the same exact circumstances.
Of course.
And whatever's going on.
That's right.
And it just how I'm reacting to it, so it can be so different.
Sure. Yeah. Yes.
I wasn't sure if you were talking about patience.
Yeah.
It seems that our world would be a gentler, kinder place if patience and generosity, which you spoke of as one of the things, were practiced vigorously.
Right.
I mean, they require a lot of attention and practice, but they give so much by their very nature of being active in offering generosity of all kinds. I have some trouble sometimes when you speak of the other who is unwise or unkind, or you didn't use the word unkind, or just like foolish. And I don't quite know what they're talking about, because that's where we have our problems sometimes.
Yeah.
We're just saying they are not us, they are foolish, and so we're in this division. And so that was one that always has been problematic a little bit. Maybe it's the archaic language, but it's something to look at.
Yeah.
Because particularly at this time,
right,
where divisions are so large, and we make these assumptions about others, we really don't know. We really often don't know, and what.
Thank you.
I still find that maybe during more by what I resist the what feels good, and when the admonition to honor the elder and honor the parents came up, I resisted that, because through my life many of the elders and simply parent figures have been kind of harsh and critical and unwise, or seemingly.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at it again, through that harshness and judgmentalism and criticism, there's a learning. You know, there's an opening. There's the necessity to understand the causes and conditions for their judgmentalism, and the need to open up to a compassionate response to it. And that's probably the most fruitful kind of learning for me. So I look for what I resist sometimes, because those are sometimes the most valuable training devices, learning devices.
Thank you.
Speaking to Marion's point about the foolish people, because that is a startling statement, and I feel much as she does, it feels divisive. But when you were saying it this time, I flashed on something that I have felt post-election with so many people who are so upset or numb or whatever, that I have been particularly grateful to have a tradition that I can go to, and that my friends that have none seem more. I'm at sea, mind you. I'm out of balance and all those things, but I have something to go to, and they don't. And that's not foolishness, but it's that to me is the difference between those words are pretty loaded, but the wise, but having that available is such a blessing, and I feel patronizingly sorry for my friends who don't have that, who don't have, they have an ethical core, they have all the things that they don't have something like this to try to ground in. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how I heard the words this time.
Mm. Thank you. Yes?
I was thinking about the freedom from fear one.
Uh-huh.
A big piece of this whole thing for me has been the guarding the sense doors, mm-hmm, piece. Watching my use of the newspaper and of the internet, like what you were talking about. And just after people started talking, I realized that I think fear has an intoxicating quality to it,
mm-hmm,
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that so it sort of, it's like there's several of those in the fear. Plus there's, to me, the practicing externally and internally part, because it's the fear that is felt in the mind. And it feels like it gets amplified by reading the newspaper. And at this point, I'm really having to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering about finding the peace in the mind, because obviously fear is around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm just kind of holding it as a question. And also, of course, wondering if I'll ever get rid of the defilements, but hey.
It's a gradual training.
Yeah, thank goodness. Very sometimes almost imperceptible, it appears, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Richard, my view of the first verse about wise and foolish was very valuable and important and good for me to hear, because there are people that you just can't relate to, or they can't relate to you, and no matter what you do or how much you pray or how many opportunities you try to make, it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And at some point you have to realize that all that energy could be going to so much other things, mm-hmm, and
right,
other people and other,
sure,
gifts, and let that negative stuff just stay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the comfort or the ability to be able to just do it and not keep fighting and trying to do something that just isn't going to happen. But it's important to, like when somebody that, I'm very, very close to my child who was on the other side of the politics, it was very hard, very hard. You know, broke my heart. But that wouldn't be a choice where I would say, oh, she's foolish and I'm not going to be in her life. You
right.
know, I just needed to give her time and me time. So it's important to take that time and do the very, very best you can. And then accept and let go.
Mm. Thank you. I'm going to do some research into this word fool and see what the root of it is, what the actual meaning is, see if we can find that out for next time. Anything else? Okay, well, I have a poem to close. And on Saturday, Bob Dylan's going to receive the Nobel Peace Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Nobel Prize for Literature. And so I thought I would share with you some of the words that were going through my head, because I'm one of these people that plays music in my head when I'm on retreat. I thought I'd share with you some of the words. And at some point I went to one of my teachers and she said, well, just for the heck of it, why don't you believe it for a while? Listen to the lyrics. Actually listen to them as if they were a message. So this is Love Minus Zero. And, you know, what I thought is... after I read this a couple times, I thought, well, let's pretend that this, his love that he's talking about, is actually someone who's practicing the Dharma, and let's see what effect that has on her life. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, but she's true, like ice, like fire. People carry roses, make promises by the hours. My love, she laughs like the flowers. Valentines can't buy her. In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk over situations, read books, and repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall. Some speak of the future. My love, she speaks softly, knows there's no success like failure, and that failure's no success at all. Statues made of matchsticks crumble into one another. My love winks. She doesn't bother. She knows too much to argue or to judge. The wind howls like a hammer. The night blows cold and rainy. My love, she's like some raven at my window with a broken wing. So, remembering that there's so much suffering in the world, and recognizing that we have the cause for happiness here, so many of the conditions for happiness just right in this room, and sharing whatever happiness, whatever wisdom you've gained tonight, the intention of having that reach as widely as it can. There's just no telling how our decision to try to be a little bit kinder, have a little bit more compassion, how that's going to ripple out into the world. So, using that intention to offer whatever positive energy we've generated here tonight by having timely discussions of the Dharma and meeting together. May all beings be happy, safe and protected. May all beings have ease. And may all beings be free from suffering. Thank you for your practice.